You're listening to Circle of Hope Sunday Meeting Podcast. This talk was given at 3800 Marlton Pike. For more information, check out circleofhope.net or join us in person on Sunday mornings at 10:30 a.m. or 7 o'clock p.m.
I want to talk about peacemaking today as a way for us to escape the show, because I'm saying that Jesus canceled the show. We get stuck in a lot of performance thinking, and I'm defining performance thinking as anything that puts you on a scale where you're between bad and good. We put others on a scale. We're always judging people. Our reaction is usually judgment, and even worse, we put ourselves on a scale all the time. Performance thinking is reinforced everywhere. So it's really hard to escape. At work, you have performance reviews. At home, you have expectations from your family members. In your own head, you have that running critic that always has something to say, always saying that was good or that was bad, and it amplifies everything. And I think that all of these judgments end up being battle lines in our whole life. We can make a battle line out of anything, gummy bears included. So here's some examples. You have a great idea for a project at work, but the problem is they put you in charge and you don't have much experience running a team. And one guy on the team is just not delivering on his part of the project. And the results, you know, they're suffering. And since you're in charge, you're getting the flack from your upper ups. You can't figure out how to motivate this guy because he thinks, or he seems to think, that he's doing the same amount of work as he always does. And maybe he is, but now you're on a team with him and his problem is your problem. There's this workflow issue, but usually it ends up being like fantasizing about how to do harm to this person, or at least how to get him got by the supervisor so that it's not your fault that the project is suffering. Or let's say you get home after a long day and neither you or your spouse have much energy left to give anything, but you still want to have like a comfortable place, like a house that doesn't have Legos all over the floor or, you know, dirty dishes all in the sink. And you'd like to eat something that it tastes okay because you're hungry after a day of work. The battle lines are quickly drawn in that moment. And now everything your beloved does is a critique on your personhood. You feel like this at all? In that grumpy moment, we evaluate the love of our most beloved based on whether they like do the dishes or clean up the Legos. I don't know if you have Legos in your house, but it's a constant problem in mine. And no matter the context, that inner voice in your head is always evaluating any decision you make, any action you take. The critic knows like everything about you because the critic is you, all your motivations. The critic doubts your capacity. The critic knows how well you could have done it if only X, Y, or Z. It's dangerous to be anywhere, and it's probably the most dangerous to be inside your head. There are enemies all around. So before we get to the Saudi war on the Yemeni rebels, or the Myanmar government, ethnic cleansing the Rohingya Muslims, or the nuclear threat in North Korea, or maybe even the gun violence right here in our neighborhood, we have tons of opportunities for peacemaking right in our own hearts and minds, and in the relationships with the people in our lives. I think if we start here, like we were just doing, we have more to give the world. We can get to the bigger fish to fry, all those big problems in the world, but I think that we become peacemakers first in our own hearts. And I think that it's a space where we might be able to have some more immediate victories so that we can be agents of peace in the world. So I wanna work on that. Let me give you another example. Every morning for the past probably a year since he moved out of a crib, my son Theodore, he's the littler one, he wakes up too early. He never used to do this before because, you know, he'd wake up, he'd be in his little cage, and he'd go back to sleep. But now he has freedom, and he wakes up unacceptably at 6 o'clock every morning. That's too early. We decided you need to sleep or stay in your room until 7 o'clock. And we got this you can't really see that. Can you kind of see that? It's this like great little invention. It's an okay to wake alarm clock. And it you set it for 7 o'clock and it lights up green because Theo's 3 and he can't tell time, but he can tell the difference between yellow and green. So when Theo wakes up at 6, though, I'm either downstairs carving out some time alone with God, or You guessed it, sleeping, like many of you would like to be doing at 6 o'clock. And every morning we say, it's not green yet. And this is responded to with screams and howls. But when will it be green? I have to obey. I have to go back in my room. Get back in your bed. Get to your room. It's not green yet. And on the inside, behind my growls, which are usually, honestly, it's a growl, you know, especially if I'm sleeping. It's, you're bad. You're disobedient. Why aren't you like your older brother? What did I do wrong? Why isn't Gwyneth taking care of this? Gwyneth is my wife. Why is this my responsibility and not hers? I just get so frustrated, and Theo's so frustrated, and we have a little battle every morning. Sometimes, though, I'm able to walk him back to his room calmly and convince him gently, okay, you woke up. This is what you do every morning. Okay, either go back to bed or play in your room. Turn your light on, that's fine. You have to wait till it turns green. Depending on the day, he'll come out 12 more times during that hour and tell us how long it's taking for the clock to turn green. Sometimes he'll stay in his room and just shout it as loud as he can, as many times as he can. Mama, it's not green yet. Yeah, we know, because we can tell time. We don't care if it's green or not. It's not 7 o'clock. But somehow it's always adorable when he explodes out of the room shouting, it's green! It's green! And he bounds around the house shouting to the world, it's green. And now that Oliver needs to get on the bus for first grade in the morning, that's a good thing because everybody needs to be up anyway. We want to live in that jubilation of it's green more often. We want the green light between us and not the battle lines. Of course, with the 3-year-old, yes, with our spouse and the rest of our family, please, with the coworkers, can we have that green light? And most of all, the biggest one, can we have that green light between, like, me and myself? Can it be okay that I'm awake and I'm alive and I'm jubilant? Can that be where I live, please? We want a green light on being ourselves. But performance thinking, this idea that I'm developing, I think it riles us up instead into quick words of judgment and battle lines. Theodore is not performing as I desire, and now I'm not performing as a parent. And all of a sudden, I'm whispering threats through clenched teeth at a 3-year-old. It's not who I want to be. You don't have to be a parent to understand how these things snowball. Our reactions are quick, and too often, before we know it, we are knee-deep in a battle that we did not choose. It happened to us. So y'all have heard of the fight or flight response, right? This is pop psychology. At this point, everyone knows about fight or flight. When something threatens us, we have this deep internal programming that goes back to when we were like running away from saber-toothed tigers or something like that, where we need to stop and fight or run away, flee, start yelling or punching or start running and hiding. The problem is that switch goes off for us for all kinds of reasons. You know, it doesn't have to be a saber-toothed tiger anymore. It triggers for all kinds of reasons. You don't have to be fighting in an actual life or death battle to feel like it's life or death, or at least a little tinge of life or death. What the response triggers deep down inside of us, this fight or flight, most of the time is like this, you know, emotional wound that happened when we were kids, when our father was growling at us in the morning. We can shut down emotionally. We can retreat within ourselves, ignore the problem, freeze in a loop of worry. Even in retreat, you're on the battlefield. There's as many ways for this to happen. You don't have to just be like a dukes up kind of person. You're still in the war when you're running, and we want to keep looking at that. You know, it could be when our mom walked out of the room, and every time, you know, the way our brain worked, we weren't sure if she was going to come back. You know, it goes that deep. This is where this stuff gets started. Like when we're a baby. And we don't have object permanence. We don't know that when something disappears, it's going to exist in any other dimension. And mom might as well be in another dimension if she's not right in my face. And she's not in my face enough for me to feel safe all the time. And that's just the trauma of growing up as a human being. There's no way to escape it. Everyone has experienced that as this fight or flight moment, even before you were conscious. And so all of us are working with that at a very basic level. But then we have had, in our experience, each of us has our own trauma that might be ongoing or different, might have lasted well into when we were teenagers, but all of us get this programming deep down in us so that when something intimate is happening, like with our spouse when we come home from work, or even with coworkers that we spend most of our time with, it gets down and touches those things and we're like, wait a second, is this really life or death? Is this really fight or flight? And it doesn't really matter because that's how you're working. Yes, it is. It is life or death because that's what's happening inside of you. So I've got one idea for this. There's lots of ways to work with this, but I've got one idea that helps us. Let's ask God to help us develop an instinct for those moments when our reactions make enemies out of everything and everyone. Let's develop a third instinct. It's not fight. It's not flight. It's wait and see. It's pause. It's observe. It's trust to see what happens. Don't leap to judgment. Take a breath and delay your decision, maybe only for just a second. This is the heart, I think, of peacemaking. And it's a good way to be in the world. I think if we were all had just even, you know, even if our collective seconds of waiting and breathing for just that one moment on the regular, we would change the world. And I think we are already in some ways. Observation, pausing and waiting and seeing. This is the first step in a process described by Marshall Rosenberger as nonviolent communication. I know some of you are familiar with this book, but it's pretty neat. And it's just a social psychologist. There's nothing Christian about this book, though it sounds a lot like Christian peacemaking to me. I think we can adopt it as a tool in all of these potential battles that we face. And I recommend reading the whole book. It's very inspiring. But I'll give you the little primer on it and really focusing on this observation. Observation is the first thing. It's that pause where I'm not going to jump to judgment. How can I describe this situation so as not to be judging anyone involved, myself included, you know? So like when I come home and I'm tired and I want to eat and the house is a mess and I'm the one that wants it to be clean, you know, how do I figure that out? You know, because the obviously right answer is, Gwyneth, this house is dirty. I'm upset. It's your fault. You know, I don't like you. In fact, I hate you. Let's have a fight. You know, that's how it goes. The observation would be, okay, so what's really going on here? You know, it's obviously more than my feelings. I come home. I've been gone all day. We have these monstrous children. And yeah, any three-year-old is a monster, right? Everyone that's had a three-year-old? Yeah? It's true. I mean, they're adorable, too. They say it's geen. But they're adorable and monstrous. So, you know, she's tired. She's been, like, running after them all day. They've been totally annoying. She doesn't have much more energy. I don't have any energy. It's just like, no, like, let's name what's going on here. Like, we're in this mess together. We chose to have these children and buy this house, you know? Like, let's observe what's going on. Get everyone off the hook and just say, okay, this is the situation. And then trying to get down to your feelings is actually quite hard because most feelings are actually judgments. There's only like, you only have like three or four feelings. Like, how does Gwyneth feel when I get home and I, you know, I start like cleaning up the toys in a judgmental way, and that's how I do it? She feels attacked. But attacked is not a feeling. Attacked is a judgment on me. Attacked is a yes, you do feel attacked, but it's not the core feeling. She's feeling, you know, there's only a few of them. Angry, and not in this situation, but you might feel happy, sad, shame. Anita is mouthing to me, and she's right. You know, there's this.
She feels that you are critiquing the way that she did.
Exactly, yes.
You are judging how she cleaned it up.
And I totally am, you know, full confession. But I'm trying not to reveal that. And so getting down to the actual feelings. What do I actually feel in this moment? And then Gwyneth is trying to figure out what she actually feels in this moment. And then getting it down to a practical, concrete need, you know? So Gwyneth might say to me, when you come home, and she says, when you come home and start cleaning up all the toys manically, and that's too judgmental, but that's what I do, so I'm judging myself there. When you start cleaning up the toys real fast, I feel ashamed because I would have liked to clean those up, but I wasn't able to. And I know that you like that, and I really want you to be happy because we're married and that's our job. But I need to have like a buffer zone when we get home where we're actually just like recovering together instead of just jumping into action. And when you get home, it's a real relief for me. And I'd like you to take the kids outside immediately or something instead of whatever you would like to. So she has that need for a buffer zone. She has this like kind of emotional need, and then she made a concrete request. And this has all happened. You know, we've had this kind of violent communication and nonviolent communication. We do it both ways all the time. Rosenberger says that the basis for nonviolent communication is empathy. First, though, is self-empathy, defined as a deep and compassionate awareness of one's own inner experience. What's actually happening inside of you? Then you can move to empathy for someone else, defined as an understanding of the heart in which we see the beauty in the other person. That's what you're looking for. And then an honest self-expression, that's what you're doing when you're naming your feelings, defined as expressing oneself authentically in a way that is likely to inspire compassion in others. How can I actually communicate how I'm feeling in a way that doesn't just shut them down and put them in fight or flight? You know, how can I take responsibility for how I'm actually communicating this as not just a verbal punch in the face? And then finally, nonviolent communication proposes that if people can identify their needs, the needs of others, and the feelings that surround these needs, peace can be achieved. It's a peacemaking tactic in how we talk to each other. Marshall Rosenberg has a bunch of great stories in this book. On his Wikipedia page, he's like got two puppets talking to each other. You know, he's like, you know, it's like a role-playing thing. Like, this is a skill you can develop. And of course, I'm still developing it, but I offer it to you as a tool as well, because it sounds a lot like Christian peacemaking. I love how simple and clear it is. It's a step-by-step process to do what Paul exhorts in his letter to the Ephesians in chapter 4. He says, speak the truth in love. And we made a proverb out of that. Truth without love kills. Love without truth lies. We actually took it from Eberhard Arnold, who's a theologian. We need to become skilled in the art of speaking the truth in love. And I think that's what nonviolent communication is. It's just one of the many ways you could speak the truth in love. Truth without love kills. Love without truth lies. So if I speak the truth about how I'm feeling and it feels like a dagger in you, that's when I'm killing you. My truth can cut you so easily. But if I just, you know, kind of wall myself off and, you know, clam up and not say anything, then I don't actually have the intimacy and the mutuality that I desire, and I'm actually lying, and the separation between me and the person I'm trying to love gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Truth without love kills. Love without truth lies. But what Marshall Rosenberg asks us to do, self-empathy, knowing what's really going on inside of you, deep compassion for another person, being able to articulate yourself in a clear and demonstrable way, and asking for your needs, all of that is such a tall order. It's like, I don't know if this is something that we can just practice our way into. Certainly it's gonna take practice, but I think we need the actual Prince of Peace to give us the hearts to do this. I don't know if this is something we can actually achieve. And without Jesus in the middle of it, I think that we could perform nonviolent communication or not, and put ourselves on a scale about how well we're following Marshall Rosenberg and his ideas about communicating well. He really put your back into like making a practice out of communicating this way, you're going to start evaluating yourself almost by default. And if you do that with without Jesus next to you, I think it's going to sink you like everything else does. It's going to stunt your progress. Because Jesus frees us from that scale. Whether we're doing it right or not, Jesus frees us up by loving us and caring for us and even filling us with the Holy Spirit so that we're empowered in a way beyond our natural capabilities. You know, we could have like nonviolent communication with God too. It's very easy to get into. I think if we think about how we're going to pray in this same way too, it would be really good. So you could have a real understanding of who you are in relationship to God. And that's where it starts. Jesus is telling us who we are, the one that he loves so much, the one that he died for. And then we move into, we could even have empathy for God. You know, we could say, what are you trying to do? I'm trying to listen. I'm trying to feel where you're moving. I want to know what we're going to do together in the world. And you'll know how you feel about that and what you need to do that with God. And all of it, all these projects that we could have always end up, because of our program, we go back to this kind of performance thinking. And now when I'm talking to God, I'm wondering if I'm doing it right. It always gets messed up by this scale we put ourselves on. And Jesus is trying to save us from that. He canceled the show. And Jesus bowed out of the show himself. He showed us how to do it. So I want to take a look at him doing it here in Matthew. Here's Jesus before Pilate. He's been arrested in the dark by an armed mob. He's been beaten and mocked, subjected to humiliation and judgment from his own people. And now he's in front of the empire's representative. And Pilate has the power to set him free or execute him. Now Jesus was standing before Pilate, the Roman governor. "Are you the king of the Jews?" the governor asked him. Jesus replied, "You have said it." But when the leading priests and the elders made their accusations against him, Jesus remained silent. "Don't you hear all these charges they are bringing against you?" Pilate demanded. But Jesus made no response to any of the charges, much to the governor's surprise. When we're tempted to like respond quickly, to react instantly, I think we can remember Jesus in this moment, and he'll give us some inspiration to pause. We also want to be people that could have a surprising silence. Don't you hear all the charges they're bringing against you? Do you hear all the charges that they're bringing against you? The charges that your spouse is bringing against you, or that you think that they might be doing? The charges you're bringing against yourself? Do you hear all the charges? I think we do. And Jesus did too. He heard them. He wasn't ignoring them. He wasn't stonewalling Pilate. But he knew without a doubt that they were false. This is where he has us. He had no stake in their opinions of him. The source of his righteousness was elsewhere. He had not sinned, but they thought he had. And he had not obeyed the thought police and the religious people. He had obeyed God. And there's the thing. The source of our righteousness is in the same place as Jesus's. Because of what Jesus did, we also have that righteousness. Even though our stories are totally different than Jesus's, we're not Jesus. We did sin. We sinned last hour. God makes us righteous as a gift. This is Jesus getting us out of this evaluation, getting us out of this show. Jesus makes no response because he's about to make a mockery of the so-called justice system that Pilate is leading. He's confronting the powers head on, submitting to the worst that they can dish out, and coming out the other side of it. He's doing more than protecting himself. He's doing more than fighting. He's doing more than preserving his honor. He's doing more than running away. He's not just winning an argument, he's defeating death. And if death is defeated, fight or flight loses its power. So I think, again, we can join Jesus in being that surprising. Even surprising to ourselves. Let's try to interrupt it a little bit. Pause. I'm just asking right now to just, when you have the opportunity, this is how you can win the day in a new way, is when that reaction comes up, just pause. See if you can observe what's happening. See if instead of fighting or fleeing, you can wait and see that there are more possibilities beyond life or death in this present moment. Because it does. It feels like life or death, and that's okay. It felt like life or death to Jesus too. Because in his case, it actually was. But we parallel that process in every one of these moments where we're getting freed from that fight or flight response, from that life or death moment, from that wound that we felt when we were children, coming up again because the one that loves me has said that thing. Almost every interaction is ready for this, and that's why it feels like these battle lines get drawn up all the time. And if we want to be peacemakers, we need to get serious about getting out of them. And Jesus leads the way. And again, it's that surprising pause. It's that wait and see. It opens us up to new practices and patterns.
Thanks for listening to Circle of Hope's Sunday Meeting Podcast. If you want to talk about it or get connected to a cell, you can find one under our Connect dropdown at circleofhope.net.